On May 19, 2004, the Foundation Incubator presented the Big New Foundations, their leaders, and their strategies for an audience of 250 people at the Pacific Athletic Club in Redwood City, California. The purpose of the event was to shed light on three large Bay Area foundations that were established by high-tech entrepreneurs and to provide insight into their leaders, their grant-making strategies, and future plans. Featured speakers included Sally Osberg, President and CEO of the Skoll Foundation, Iqbal Peru, COO of Omidyar Network, and Lou Coleman, President of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. The conversation was moderated by Catherine Fulton, President of the Monitor Institute and a partner with Global Business Network, and introduced by the Foundation Incubator President, Liz Bremner. The following is an edited audio transcript of the discussion.
For those of you that are new to the Foundation Incubator, or TFI, since our beginnings 3 years ago, the incubator has developed an engaged peer community of new, emerging, and established foundations and donors who come together to learn from each other, to share innovative approaches, to collaborate, and to build long-lasting relationships and networks. We offer customized workshops, small discussion groups, and one-on-one coaching, both in Palo Alto and San Francisco. Our conversation today will be moderated by Catherine Fulton, and her role is to facilitate and stimulate thinking, to probe and uncover some of the influences behind the thinking of our speakers. Catherine's lifelong interest in leadership and learning has led her to positions as a reporter, publishing executive, nonprofit leader, and university teacher. Today, she is the president of the Monitor Institute, whose mission is to support and catalyze social innovation. She is also a partner with Global Business Network, where she helps organizations anticipate and shape their futures. And I'm going to introduce the speakers in the order in which that they are going to be speaking. Lou Coleman, for most of his career, has held top positions in financial and banking industries. He was vice chairman of the board and CFO of Bank of America and chairman of Bank of America Securities until he resigned in late 2000 to become the president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Sally Osberg joined the Skoll Foundation as its first president and CEO in 2001. Before Skoll, she directed the Children's Discovery Museum of San Jose and helped grow the museum from its inception to a national leader. Sally's expertise in organizational development and strategic positioning have made her a pioneer in the social sector for two decades. And finally, Iqbal Peru, for the last 30 years, has served as a chief executive of healthcare organizations in the United States, Europe, the Caribbean, and Asia. He was president and CEO of Hahnemann University in Philadelphia, where he led a major financial turnaround and advanced the school to one of the highest ranked institutions of its kind in the region. In 2002, he joined the Omidyar Foundation, and now he serves as president of the Omidyar Network. And I'm pleased to turn the program over to Catherine Fulton. Thank you, Catherine.
So why are we all here? There's a generational and a cultural shift underway in philanthropy and in the whole social benefit arena that we all know about. What's big and what's new isn't just these foundations, it's the whole sector in a quite profound way. And it's a time of increase in private power in which many of the old equations are shifted, in which there are new centers of power in the world. And philanthropy is a key and growing resource, and I think of it as building networks of hope to combat networks of fear. And I think that much of the things that matter the most on this planet in the next generation, you'll be able to go backwards and find very generous kinds of philanthropy at the seed of many of the things that urgently are needed in our time. But philanthropy can't be thought of in the aggregate. 65% of the largest foundations in this country, and large actually means with giving away over $100,000 a year. 65% of those foundations have been founded in the last 20 years. The thing about philanthropy is that it doesn't work in the aggregate. It's voluntary, it's deeply personal for the most part, And from the outside, it can therefore look eccentric, arbitrary, idiosyncratic, pick your word. In the stories that form why people do what they do and give in extraordinary ways. And that's the privilege that we have today, to hear those stories and to see it from the bottom up. We have representatives of three of the high-tech pioneers of different generations. And the three people they chose for the important and quite intimate role of being their main philanthropic partner. Other than the fact that they're from big, new foundations, they may not actually have a lot else in common, as I think we may discover. That's part of why we've all heard the, if you've seen one foundation, you've seen one foundation, cliche about philanthropy. They're each going to speak for a few minutes and tell you the basics about their foundation and the journey that they've been on so far to build these philanthropic entities. We decided to call on them in the order in which of their seniority in the philanthropy world. So they have entered, Lou was actually in his job first, and then Sally, and then Iqbal. And so as the senior citizen of the group, in terms of great experience in philanthropy, I'm going to call on you, Lou, first.
Thank you. Thank you very much. More and more I'm known as a senior citizen, so I do appreciate the remark. Let me give you the thumbnail sketch on the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation so that at least you have a context in which to think about us. We were founded in November of 2000. Gordon gave us 5 million shares of Intel, put 170 million shares of Intel in a charitable remainder trust, which matured in February on Valentine's Day of 2003. So in a real sense, we not only are not sure what we're doing, we just got the money to figure out what we're doing, so fairly new. One of the advantages of having living donors is you get to do this. Sort of talking to them about what it was they expected to see happen in philanthropy. And when you think about it, it's their money, and it is really as much up to them to tell us as it is for us to interpret that day to day inside the foundation. And the Moores really told us two things. They said, we would like you to have an area of concentration, and that's essentially science, higher education, and biodiversity. They told us they did not want us to do everything in those fields, but they also told us they didn't want us to drift very far out of those fields, that mission drift was a real concern. And secondly, they told us what everybody tells you, and that is we also want you to be effective in your grant making. But in this particular case, they were very specific about what they said. And in fact, they said, if you cannot be effective, don't do it. Don't feel you have to cover the landscape. And so we, of course, said, well, that sounds good, but what's effective? And Gordon, as he's able to do very succinctly, said, there's really three things I think you need to think about when you're making a grant. First of all, is it important? Is the grant you're making important? Is the activity you're involved in important? And Gordon described importance as much as anything else as long-lasting. And he describes long-lasting in 100-year increments. And so he really said, what I want you to do is sort of concentrate on long-term problems. He said, secondly, it would be nice if you could do something where we could make a difference. Don't get into fields that are too crowded where you get lost. And third, he said, it would be nice to measure the outcomes. So if you think about these as three screens, doing things that are important, having measurable outcomes, and making a difference eliminates about 95% of the good causes in the world. They tend to just disappear in front of your very eyes. They turn out to be pretty tough basic tests as you think about grant making. But with those instructions and with the knowledge that as a baseline, Gordon could have just paid his taxes and the government would have taken the money and done something with it. And some people have argued that's the best place for this kind of money to go. Or he could have picked two or three universities and filled their endowments fairly adequately. We decided that we had to do something better than that, that was our baseline. If we couldn't do better, there was no point spending the $20 million a year that we spend to try to make the Moore Foundation run. So we had an idea on a relative basis what it is we needed to do and how it was that we needed to do it better. Out of this came our vision, which is really creating positive outcomes for future generations. In particular, we do concentrate on what's going to happen to the next generation and try not to get overly excited about some of the serious problems in today's world if it doesn't look like it's a long-term problem. So that does narrow our field of focus fairly quickly. Our mission says something like, as responsible stewards to the resources that have been entrusted to us, we will basically form and invest in partnerships, which is how we like to think about our grant making, to achieve significant and measurable results in the areas that the Moores told us to do it. And that also we will try to operate organizationally as an organization that is informed, respectful, focused, and agile. The scope of our enterprise at the moment is that we're clearly global. Over half our grant making goes overseas. Probably the biggest reason for that is that we found it's easier to make a difference. It's less crowded, even though it's more complicated and probably more risky for a whole variety of reasons. We are located in the US in multiple locations. In fact, we're located where mostly our senior people want to live. That is a strategy to try to get the best people possible. Structurally, we're a pretty flat organization. We try to believe in transparency. We ask the whole foundation to look at every grant made and to express their concern or their support if they want to. So all grants go up on a grant log and must be posted for 10 business days before they go through the approval process. If it's a board-approved grant or any other kind of grant, all of the employees' comments are appended to the grant application and go to the approval source. And some of the comments are very interesting. Some of them come from unlikely places and turn out to be very helpful in the sort of difficult business of doing grants. In our relatively short life, we committed to over $1 billion in grants to date. Most of them are very large commitments. We tend to aggregate our commitments around very defined issues. And we like to make multiple grants against a single issue. And in fact, we even like to create some competition out there so that we can get a portfolio effect and some diversification around our grants. So we have a program to try to assure the abundance and diversity of Pacific salmon for the next 100 years. That would be an example of what we call an initiative. We have 65 different grantees, all trying to mitigate about 7 different categories of threats affecting Pacific salmon, ranging from watershed issues to dams, to salmon farming, to hatcheries, to fishing, to what's happening on the Kamchatka Peninsula, where a third of all wild Pacific salmon are born. So it takes you around an area where you can get good domain knowledge, where you have a defined universe in terms of who to decide should help you, with a single objective that multiple grantees participate in. And we're currently doing that in the Amazon Andes. We're doing it with nursing. We're doing it with marine microbiology. We're doing it a little bit in astrophysics. So that's how we've attempted, or those are the choices that we've made, to try to take the instructions that we have from our living donors and do what we hope is what they want. Of course, the problem with this business is we don't know yet if we've actually done that. Thank you.
I'm Sally Osberg, and I want to thank the Foundation Incubator for inviting the three of us to talk with you. And I realize one of the things we have in common is that we work for, quote, living donors. But I'll tell you, I don't think of Jeff Skoll as a living donor. I think of him as Jeff. And I'll start by telling you just a little bit about the Jeff that I've come to know over the 3 years that we've been partnering and working together. He's Canadian, but he doesn't have much of an accent. He is, however, a hockey fan. He loves a good joke, and if he were here, he'd be starting with a joke, so I apologize that I'm not. He came to California from his native Canada in the mid-90s and did his MBA at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Shortly upon graduating with his degree in hand, he was invited by Pierre Omidyar to join him in creating the online auction company that would become eBay. And Jeff, with his newly minted degree, said to Pierre with a very straight face, "That's the stupidest idea I ever heard." And with that, though, his entrepreneurial spirit got the better of him, and they were off and running, and now eBay is one of the remarkable phenomena, I think, of our time, with its community and values of empowerment, all of which Jeff has deployed in developing his approach to his philanthropy. The Jeff I know is really a far more complex and interesting person than could ever be described as simply a living donor. I like to say that he has the mind of an engineer. He's disciplined, analytical, very attuned to good processes. He has the heart of an artist. He read intensely as a child and admires great writers and great ideas, and is now working to create films. So he really is attracted to creative milieu, creative people, and intensely creative himself. And then he has the soul of an entrepreneur. He had started two companies by the time he was in his early 30s, and really sees that ideas in the hands of someone who can make something happen to create impact is our best hope for a better future, regardless of which sector you're deploying that creative talent in. So the heart of an artist, the mind of an engineer, and the soul of an entrepreneur. And that's really the gestalt for the Skoll Foundation. The Skoll Foundation, as probably most of you know, advances systemic change to benefit communities around the world by investing in, connecting, and celebrating social entrepreneurs. Now, when Jeff started the foundation in 1999, he didn't know the term social entrepreneur. When I came on board in 2001, I had never heard the term social entrepreneur. And you know, we really haven't discovered this phenomenon, I'm sorry to tell you, but we are very excited about these human beings. They are not a new phenomenon in the human race. If you think about this year, which is the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education and that landmark ruling, track back on that. And it takes you to some very interesting people, all of whom were social entrepreneurs. Jane Addams, for example, who founded Hull House and then became very active in immigrants' rights and one of the founders of the NAACP. The NAACP is one of the social sector institutions that brought the case that Thurgood Marshall argued, and you know, the rest is history, and we're still all, as a democracy, fighting that good fight. But my point is that social entrepreneurs are extraordinary men and women who dedicate their minds, their hearts, and their lives to creating social value. And these are the people the Skoll Foundation was created to back. They're people like J.B. Schramm, founded an organization called College Summit, which is striving to bring a college education to the 200,000 kids nationally who fall through the cracks because they don't have access to the traditional supports that would get them into college. People like Martin Fisher, working in Kenya, founded an organization called Apertech that has resulted over 10 years in creating 33,000 new businesses that collectively generate some 35 million annually in new wages and profits and account for 0.5% of Kenya's GDP. These are people who are creating real value, social value, and in the case of someone like Martin Fisher, they're building a constituency for democracy.